Our scripture reading for this morning will be taken from the book of Joshua, chapter 9. Joshua, chapter 9, beginning with verse 1. And I'll be reading from the New American Standard Bible. Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country and in the lowland and on all the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite heard of it, that they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out and torn and mended and worn out and patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us." The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" And they said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey and go to meet them and say to them, "We are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us." This our bread was warm when we took for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. These wineskins which we filled were new, and behold, they are torn. And these our clothes and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore on an oath to them. Have you ever made a bad bargain? Discovered too late that an agreement or a partnership was less than best? Rushed into an alliance that turned out to do you harm, to be bad for you? It's not hard to do, is it? To lean upon one's own insights and in an attempt to be reasonable, to do things that just make sense, to perhaps compromise in order to keep the peace, to come away with that which is less than ideal, if not actually harmful. One of the questions we always need to ask ourselves is this: what God would have me to do? Jeremiah says in Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 23, "I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps." We must acknowledge that God is the one that is all-knowing. That doesn't mean that we don't strive to be decisive in matters, but we do it with insight given to us not from just the realm of common sense or in compliance with our consciences, because we know even Saul of Tarsus had a clear conscience when he was persecuting Christians, as he reveals in Acts chapter 23 and verse 1. It's not that we should ignore those, But we must always admit, like Jeremiah just did in Jeremiah 10:23, that it's the Lord who knows all. And only in the Lord can we make the steps, decisions, agreements, and bargains that are appropriate. The title of my lesson for this morning is Bad Deal. Now, the children of Israel have just gone up to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim in the final verses of chapter 8, read the blessings and the curses. And it was from that that in chapter 9 now, as we began with verse 1, because of that gathering, that the kings in the land of Canaan decided, okay, we're going to have to fight this out. They decided that they needed to fight against Joshua and Israel. It had become clear to them. And we're going to see that play out, at least the beginnings of it in chapter 10, throughout the rest of the book of Joshua, certainly, this conflict between Israel and the people of the land. But recorded for us here in chapter 9 is a rather curious incident with the men of Gibeon. God had said in Exodus chapter 23, so this is 40 years ago, by the way, the incidents taking place from the first chapter of Joshua clear up to chapter 14 and verse 10 are bookended for us by Caleb as he describes his age at the time that he was a spy along with Joshua up till now. And it says that it has been 45 years since the time that they spied out the land. 40 years of wandering, 5 years. What that provides for us is a five-year period for the incidents between Joshua chapter 1 and up to Joshua chapter 14 to have transpired. So things are moving rather quickly. But God had said, as you go into the land of Canaan, 40 years earlier, at least, in Exodus chapter 23 and verse 32, talking of the nations that would be in the land of Canaan, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. And if you don't have that as a cross-reference written in, you might want to do that in Joshua chapter 9 and verse 15. Just write that cross-reference, Exodus 23, verse 32. And you say, but that was said 40 years ago. Yes, but it has just been read again, hasn't it? Between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. So it's fresh on their mind. God had said to Abraham, there will come a time when I will give this land to your descendants. Listen to these words now in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 16. He has just told Abraham that your descendants are going to be in captivity. They'll be servants of another nation. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here. For the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. Now we know from Paul's writing in the book of Galatians that this is a 430-year period between this prophecy given to Abraham and the children of Israel coming back to conquer the land of Canaan. What we have then is God waiting over four centuries for his cup of wrath to become full. In other words, that was 400 years that God said he was going to wait until the iniquity of the Amorites was complete. Now, I think that says that God is patient. Yet, when it comes time to punish, and that's what's happening now, God's cup of wrath is full, and Israel, with its army, is to bring judgment upon the tribes of Canaan. God is the God of all men, as we learned in that battle against the city of Jericho. And yet, God is merciful, as we find with one of the inhabitants of Jericho, Rahab and her family, God sparing their lives because Rahab was a woman of faith. Yet even God's people, during the time of Jeremiah, about 800 years from right now, Jeremiah writes, and this includes God's people with regards to punishment and judgment. This is in Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 15 and 16. For thus the Lord, the God of Israel, says to me, take this cup of the wine of wrath from my hand and cause all the nations to whom I send you to drink it. They will drink and stagger and go mad because of the sword that I will send among them. And as I said, sadly, that included Jeremiah's prophecies against God's own people, the southern tribes, also known as Judah. And they were carried away into Babylonian captivity, and Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed. What that says is that man is not consistent in his faithfulness, that there can readily be falling away if man doesn't take time to consult the counsel of God, as we're seeing here in this lesson today in Joshua chapter 9, verses 14 and 15. Or it can affect an entire people as they cease to look to God for wisdom and for guidance. Let me read what Jeremiah had said earlier in Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23. Once again, I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. One of the key lessons, thus the title for today's sermon, Bad Deal, one of the key lessons from this chapter in Joshua 9 is that once again, Joshua fails to seek God's counsel and suffers for it. You say, well, when was the other time? Well, not too far back, whenever they were developing their plan to go against Ai. He had sent out spies. They came back there. He said they were a little group, send only 3,000 or so, and they got defeated in the first attack against Ai. Now, it was because there was sin within the camp, because Achan had stolen and taken of the banned items. But there we saw no evidence of Joshua consulting the Lord before that battle against Ai. Whenever he repents and they rid themselves of the sin within the camp, then God repurposes the incident of being chased away by the men of Ai and turns it into an ambush. And Israel is soundingly victorious in that battle. How is it that here, verse 14 simply says, they did not ask for the counsel of the Lord? How is it that they could have so quickly reverted to believing that they knew what was best? I'm not sure just how a man can do that so quickly, but he does it. And we know within our own lives that we've made our own bad bargains, agreements and partnerships and alliances that cause us to suffer because we have stepped perhaps out of ignorance, unintentionally, after all, we can't see into the future, we have done that which is not in agreement with what the Lord would have us to do. So Joshua fails to consult the Lord. He believes in the duplicity and deception of the men from Gibeon. And they have been very convincing, haven't they? They have played their part to the hilt. He said in verse 6, as they come to Joshua and his men, we come from a far country. Verse 9, they turn that into a very far country. But they've got the props to support it. It says that whenever they set out from their town, that they took worn out sacks on their donkeys, verse 4, wineskins that were worn out and needed mending. Their clothes were already worn out, their sandals and the things that they were wearing. And so they told many lies in convincing Joshua and the elders of the people that they were from a very far country. But that all could have been displaced with a single prayer to God, turning to God and saying, God, what do we do in this situation? We know what you have told us in Exodus. Of course, they wouldn't have had Exodus 23:32. As in book, chapter, and verse. But we know what you said through Moses, that we were not to make alliances. Are these people from near to us? Instead, it took them 3 days to discover. And even that, it doesn't appear, is because of prayer. Verse 16 of Joshua 9, it came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Oh, how chagrined they must have felt. Now, the city of Gibeon is not far from the city of Ai, just a few miles. It's just a little southwest, and we know that Ai is 9 miles north of Jerusalem when we saw that on the map. And Gibeon is but 4, maybe 5 miles, according to historian Josephus, from the city of Ai. In fact, in chapter 10, when we get to that next week, Lord willing, we're going to find out that from Gilgal, where Joshua is having this meeting with the men of Gibeon, from Gilgal to Gibeon is a night's march. And looking at the map, you'll see that Gibeon is about 20 miles. Can you imagine an army of Israel marching 20 miles in a night? Perhaps God's hand was involved there, but there have been those who have said, well, that's not an impossible task to do. And so these men that have traveled from afar, yea, a very far country, have come only 20 miles to visit and to make this covenant with Joshua. But it appears that they've gone home by the time, within 3 days, Joshua and his men discover that they are actually neighbors. And so in verse 17, then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were in Gibeon, Shephira, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. And so it's actually 4 cities that are specifically named that are in this covenant agreement, not just the men of Gibeon. Now, Gibeon itself means hill, and that city has been discovered. They have excavated Gibeon. They have found that it was a prosperous city, and we know that they are valiant warriors. It's not because they are weak and defenseless that the men of Gibeon have made this league. They simply understand that they're going to be annihilated if they don't do something and do something quick. And by their guile, by their deceptive measures, they have deceived. And yet, an oath has been made, as we saw in verse 15, with the elders, with Joshua of the people of Israel. And so even in confronting them 3 days later after this oath, they defend themselves, this time not with lies, but with truth, because they feel safe. They feel secure. They have pledged to be the servant of Joshua. He thought them not to be a threat because they came from a far country. He didn't seek God's counsel. And now they simply say what's on their mind, and the truth is this. And so there is truth within the men of Gibeon and insight. They say, we know, verse 24, because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore, we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Does this sound reminiscent of Rahab to the spies? She says to them, to the spies, after a 40-year span of Israel wandering, she says, all the people of the land melt in fear before you because we know what you did in Egypt, what your God did in Egypt. Here the men of Gibeon have the same reports, and that shouldn't be surprising, should it? But here is a nation of men, or a kingdom, if you will, responding, whereas at Jericho it was but a woman and her family, saying, we know that Moses, as your leader, through God's power, did horrendous things to Egypt, and that your God had declared that this land would be yours. And all the inhabitants of the land were to be destroyed. If you remember last week, whenever the reading at Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim was performed, that all the men were there, all the women were there, all the children were there, and so were strangers. Now, I'm not saying that that is where the men of Gibeon learned, but it is immediately after that that they take their action. Certainly, it would have refreshed their mind about the God of Israel and his power. But here they are speaking truth. That's remarkable, isn't it? Men who were in the position of being so deceiving when confronted with it said, "What choice did we have? We believe what your God did to the Pharaoh of Egypt." Earlier they had said, "We know what he did to Sihon and to Og, the kings that are on the east side of the Jordan, even just recently. We feared your God." Now, is this simply survival instinct? Or could there be even more going on here? Gibeon was a prosperous city, as we have mentioned before. It's been found. Also found in the excavations have been 66 wine cellars, which hold a multitude of liters of wine for storage at an even temperature. The pools of Gibeon are mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. In 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 13, the captain of Saul's army, Abner, meets up with the captain of David's army, Joab. And Joab and Abner allow a dozen each of their men to fight it out. And they basically just slay each other, not resolving anything. All 24 of them die. That happens at the pool of Gibeon. Curiously, the pool of Gibeon is actually a cistern. It is a rock well dug out from the earth that proceeds multiple meters deep with 79 steps leading to the bottom. And then it angles off a cave of sorts, a tunnel, angles off toward the stream so that Gibeon could have fresh water. There's actually two of those found at Gibeon. And so we have record of the pool at Gibeon. In the next chapter, when I mention, is this just survival mode or is there more going on here? Because the men of Gibeon do have a knowledge of truth and insight. When it comes time to defend the men of Gibeon from the alliance of five kings, God takes a hand in that, a miraculous hand, in delivering the men of Gibeon. Does that mean God, though it is a bad deal because Joshua has not sought his counsel, God honors the agreement and even protects the men? What is it that God sees in the men of Gibeon? What did he see in Rahab the harlot and her family? Though this was not part of what Joshua was commanded to do, God repurposes. And the men of Gibeon, you say, well, they really don't fare well. Well, is being a servant, a hewer of wood, and a gatherer of water not better than being annihilated? The men of Gibeon continue to be the servants of the house of the Lord. In fact, we find that possibly one of the first leaders of Israel, King Saul, is a partial descendant of the men of Gibeon. Now, for some odd reason, in 2 Samuel chapter 21, we find allusion to an incident when David is king and Saul has already passed away. We find allusion to an incident where Saul tries to annihilate the men of Gibeon. That's rather odd if he is partial Gibeonite himself. But David only comes to learn about it because there has been a 3-year drought in the land. And he goes to God and he says, what's the problem here? And God says, I am punishing you for what Saul tried to do. And David goes to the men of Gibeon and says to them, how do we make this right? And they said, it's not money that we want. We want Saul's descendants. Give us 7 of his sons. David does give them 2 actual sons of Saul and 5 grandsons of Saul, and they slay them. Now, once again, if you want to read that, that's in 2 Samuel chapter 21. This is 400 plus years after the time that we're reading about now here in Joshua. The period of the judges has already transpired. David's son, Solomon, will offer 1,000 sacrifices at the high places in Gibeon, or at Gibeon. It's recorded for us in 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 3 through 6. And it says there that the tabernacle had been relocated at Gibeon. We're going to find the initial place of the tabernacle to be at Shiloh as we continue now through Joshua. And it is at Shiloh that the tabernacle resides through nearly all the period of the judges, right up until the time of the death of Eli. Samuel is already a young man and at the tabernacle because Hannah, his mother, has dedicated him to the Lord. When the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, carry off the Ark of the Covenant in the battle against the Philistines, against God's will, and the Ark of the Covenant is removed from the tabernacle at Shiloh, the Philistines not only have possession of it, but history reveals that they likely also attacked Shiloh, the place where the Ark of the Covenant resided, believing that they could destroy the God of Israel. It's at that point that the tabernacle is relocated at Gibeah. So this is in the closing moments of the time of the judges, even up until the time of Solomon, because he's offering 1,000 sacrifices at Gibeon, where the tent of meeting is located. That is at least 80 plus years that this location of the duplicitous men of Gibeon becomes the residing place for the tabernacle. Now, the Ark of the Covenant doesn't ever reside at Gibeon. In fact, it resides for a long period of time at Kiriath-Jearim. Remember, that's one of the cities that are in the covenant agreement. Gibeon, Beeroth, Chephira, and Kiriath-Jearim. The Ark is there for 2 decades before finally being brought by David to Jerusalem and placed in a tent that David had specially prepared. David wanting to build the permanent temple at Jerusalem, being refused that, God saying, Solomon, your son, will do it. And finally, during Solomon's reign, when the temple is complete, the Ark of the Covenant once again resides within the holy place at the temple. In all of that, all I'm trying to say is that God works with this bad deal that Joshua made. God repurposes the people of that area who make this covenant agreement, giving them once again the opportunity to be his servants, perhaps simply literally as hewers of wood and drawers of water, but they are certainly exposed to the teachings of God for 400 years. God punishing Israel when Saul tried to destroy the men of Gibeon, still honoring the oath that Joshua had made. I want to sing a song now, 779, and I want you to think about it. It's entitled, I Will Sing of the Mercies of the Lord, from the standpoint of the men of Gibeah and their surrounding cities. 779. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing, I will sing. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness, thy faithfulness. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing, I will sing, I will sing of the mercies of the Lord forever. I will sing of the mercies of the Lord. And aren't we glad that God is merciful? Though we might think that this incident in Joshua chapter 9 is a bad deal, and it was, they should have sought God's counsel, we still see God working, showing mercy, providing leadership and guidance for the children of Israel, and ultimately delivering the land of Canaan to them, although it's not without the people of the land being a thorn in their flesh for the rest of their existence. It's not because God doesn't know. It's because man fails to seek His counsel. On the marquee, avoid making a bad alliance. Seek the Lord's counsel.